This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Daniel Paris. I'm delighted to have as my guest today, Morvan Lalouette. He is a PhD candidate at the University of Kent, and Dr. Ben Noble. He is an associate professor of politics at University College London. They are the co-authors, along with Jan-Matti Dolban, of the just published Navalny, Putin's Nemesis and Russia's Future. That is the first full-length biography account of a pivotal figure in Russian politics and society right now. Gentlemen, thank you so much for agreeing to be on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
You have the first mover advantage. Congratulations. So I understand the tale that you told about why you wrote this book was simple. Does one of you want to chime in with the very simplistic and, boy, let's fix this problem reason why you wrote this book?
Yeah, well, it was just being inundated with questions from people who don't follow Russian politics for us to say, okay, what are the resources that will allow us to make sense of who Alexei Navalny is? And those requests for information peaked really when Navalny returned to Russia at the beginning of this year. And my next door neighbor at CIS, as in the academic who has their office next door to me on the top floor of the CIS building, the School of Slavonic and East European Studies at UCL, Dr. Sean Hanley said, well, if you can't find a book, if there isn't a book out there, write it yourself. So I sent a Twitter message to Morvan and Jan on the 29th of January, and the rest is history.
And you three are all at different institutions, but you're all young academics. How did you happen to know each other and that you would be able to work together on this project so quickly? Because this is this book was produced rapidly, written rapidly, produced rapidly, distributed rapidly.
We knew each other from Twitter, and I had met Jan once, but I didn't know Ben. And we were a bit active on Twitter, and this is how Ben Noble found us.
Yeah, I'd met Jan once at a conference, but never met Morvan, but knew that they were both doing excellent work. And I think if we think that Twitter sometimes is a bit of a hellscape, this is one success story that it can make you aware of people. It puts people on your radar. And so I knew that they were producing independently really good research. So I thought, if I am going to be able to put together a team to write a book on Navalny at speed, these are the two to do it.
Excellent. Well, I agree with you at least on one point there, that a rare positive usage of social media, this should be trumpeted because in my own experience, I haven't had that yet. Congratulations. So this book is important. Navalny is an important figure. In the green room and in discussions beforehand, I observed to both of you that I have a concern, and I think your book addresses it really nicely, why I think it should be read closely by people following Russia, about the difference between the Western perception, the Russia watcher perception of Navalny, and Navalny himself. And your book is structured in a very nice way to, I think, make sure readers get a sense of Navalny in his context, not how Russia watchers want to see Navalny. Can you describe how you've set up the book, kind of the three silos, and how that addresses that perception issue?
It goes back to the origin story for the book. I think that we were frustrated as people who had been following Alexei Navalny independently before his poisoning and before his return to Russia at the beginning of this year. We were frustrated by the media coverage, less the Russia watching community coverage, but the media coverage in the West about Alexei Navalny and about Russian politics more broadly. It can be very Manichean, very black and white, very good versus bad, Navalny versus Putin, good versus evil. And that narrative, that simplistic narrative, was being politicized in a way that meant that people couldn't understand certain elements of the Navalny story. For example, Amnesty International labeling him a prisoner of conscience, but then taking it away, pointing to past statements that he's made, and then relabeling him a prisoner of conscience. So I think that added to that sense of complexity. And we wanted to write a book that broke down that black and white approach, that binary approach to understanding Navalny and Russia more broadly. And we could do that because it's not as if we've got any skin in the game. We're external academics. We can say we're going to look at the shades of gray without that being interpreted necessarily as political.
Yeah, if I may just add to this, and I can then explain the three silos, as you said. There's another type of politicization that we wanted to avoid, is either on the one hand, overblowing the importance of Navalny and saying, well, if there was a free election tomorrow in Russia, Navalny would defeat Putin outright because he's that beacon of freedom for all Russians. And on the other hand, that, Kremlin or pro-Kremlin talking point that Navalny is just a blogger. And this is a more subtle politicization surrounding the Navalny case that we wanted to avoid. And by putting Navalny in context, by looking at what kind of support does he actually have in Russia, try to convey what's the real place of Russia, of Navalny in Russian politics today. And so how we did this is in the first three chapters after the introduction, we divided Navalny's career, Navalny's activities in three strands: the anti-corruption activist, the politician, and the protester. So of course, this is in a sense artificial because Navalny has been these three roles for much of his life and active career in politics. But we thought that since we're not going down the traditional biography route with precise chapters, childhood, youth, and then business career, whatever, we felt that this simplification could help the reader grasp the breadth of Navalny's activity, which is clearly something that sets him apart from other opposition politicians in Russia today.
I wonder if part of the issue is in structural, in terms of media, that a newspaper account doesn't have the time or the depth to point out the subtleties, whereas a book or academics can. And a newspaper account, even a good one, the Big Read in the FT, even that type of account still is strongly biased by the expectations of what they'd like to see in Navalny, which is what my issue for Western media treatment of him as opposed to what he is. And I think, again, you're putting out, not in the traditional biographical sense, but in his functional sense, these three different functions that he has followed is very, very helpful. Let's kind of dive into the Navalny that the newspaper readers don't see.
Well, I was just going to say that it sounds maybe a bit of a cliche that the academics come along and say, oh, it's far more complicated than you non-academics think it is. And hopefully we're doing more than that, because you're right to say that it's not just a function of the existing assumptions of people. It's not necessarily just a function of the length of a newspaper piece not being able to get into the subtlety. It's driven by what people want to see in Navalny, this desire in the West to see somebody who's going to be a natural ally of them, that, for example, if he were to be elected president of the Russian Federation, then he'd immediately be on board with the Western agenda. What we show in the book is that that's just not the case. And that wishful thinking can lead to real problems. It can lead to those moments of jarring when people in the West think they know how Navalny is going to react to a certain incident, but he reacts differently, and then they maybe feel betrayed. But Navalny doesn't owe anything to the West. He's a Russian politician in Russia, granted now behind bars, and there are certainly people in the West who want to help him. But at the end of the day, his fate is going to be decided in the country. And so the book, yes, you're quite right, is an attempt to say, stop looking at Navalny through Western glasses, try and understand where he's coming from, what he's saying, why what he has said has changed over time by thinking about the Russian context and how that's evolved over the last 20 years.
And I think that the Western context is that the projection of what I would call classical liberalism onto Navalny is a function of the Western, some Russian watchers or the mass media wanting to see a particular outcome, a projection, and not just seeing them through Western eyes, but literally what they would like to see happen in Russia. This has been an issue for centuries, really, as Westerners have engaged Russia and project their own expectations. And Navalny's almost perfect. He's telegenic. He speaks perfectly. He's really good on YouTube. I mean, the technology skills there, he makes very good videos. There's no doubt about it. So it's easy to project onto him what a Western observer or writer would like to see. But let's delve into Navalny, the lawyer, Navalny, the businessman, the corruption candidate, corruption campaigner, very interesting stuff, really good videos. And then finally, the Navalny, the politician.
Do you want to start with the corruption, Ben, or
sure. You go for it, move on.
Well, so in the anti-corruption activist chapter, we kind of trace what's made Navalny famous in the first place, and what is, in a sense, his distinctive contribution to what you have called the liberal tradition or the liberal camp in Russia, which was to bring the issue of corruption to the fore and to use it as a way to mobilize people and to draw people to liberalism. Because, of course, Navalny is not the typical liberal, although he does advocate some definitely liberal policies, and he has liberal politics. Of course, he advocates a rule of law state, democracy, independence of justice, free media, etc. So all this is present in his agenda. But at the time where he starts digging into corruption, I think that he finds this as an attractive graphic way to draw people to this agenda that is, for obvious reason, for anyone who knows Russia, completely unattractive to people. And so with different steps from minority shareholder activism, his blog, then his investigation on state procurements using the new openness and government in Russia in the Medvedev years, Navalny brings both a technical approach to corruption, where he shows with legal documents, databases, etc., how corruption actually operates in Russia. And he finds a way to package it in, as you said, Daniel, a fun, engaging way. Even before YouTube, his blog was actually fun to read with memes. And this is, of course, what drew Westerners to him.
Can I ask one question about the bureaucratic campaigner, because or the corruption campaigner, and it's about Russian bureaucracy. I think Western observers of Navalny on the corruption side are amazed by the documents that he digs up. And I think there's an explanation there they're not very familiar with, which is, as Russia watchers, we're all accustomed to the extremely bureaucratic nature of Russian political culture, Soviet political culture, and Russian political culture before that. And so I think someone who's not that familiar with that would be surprised that the documents that they dig up even existed in the first place and then become available one way or another. But I think he's been very successful as a publicizing corruption, because to some extent that Russian political culture can't even help itself. It produces voluminous documentation of corruption in a way that maybe some other political cultures would have put less pen to paper and document the transfer of properties quite the same way that Russia seems to do. Is that, has that come up in conversations before about how almost easy it was for his team to document the corruption?
I don't think anyone would say that it's easy, but I think you're quite right that their capacity to do it is based on the idea that there are lots of bits of paper that maybe many bureaucrats don't think anybody is going to bother to look at. And certainly in my own research, I've capitalized on that with the State Duma. They make lots of information available, I think, because they think nobody is going to have the patience to sift through it all. So you can find some juicy nuggets. Of course, what Navalny and his team have dug up are far more interesting than what I dig up in the Duma, but it's the same logic that just the sheer amount of paper means that it's a happy hunting ground to find stuff. We should also say, though, that this is another important dimension of the book. We don't just look at Navalny and those three strands, we also look at how he has adapted and how the Kremlin has adapted to him over time. And one of those clear adaptations is that when Navalny and his team carry out these investigations, exploit the openness, the sometimes surprising openness of bureaucracy in terms of the information that you can get, then the authorities respond to that and they cut it down. They bring down the barrier. They make it much more opaque. They make it much more difficult for people to find those juicy nuggets that I mentioned. And so the Kremlin definitely adapts to those openings that Navalny and his team exploit. And I should say, you know, Navalny is responsible for the aesthetic and for the broad thrust, the use of social media. But one of the reasons why his videos are so slick is because he's got a really good team around him who have been able to bring their own skill set. So it's not just Navalny alone. And that's one of the things we try and make clear in the book. One of the reasons why One of the reasons why the investigations are so impressive is because he's got lots of people working flat out at the same time.
In the last few weeks, those people have had to come to the fore, Leonid Volkov in particular, but Lyuba Sobol, who's had to flee. One more question on the corruption side. And I think you addressed this, but again, it struck me. Silo about corruption and his success in showing extensive corruption, a kleptocracy, has had, I think, zero impact on the polity. And that's a subjective assertion. Feel free to disagree. That is, Russians turn a blind eye, don't care. It's not enough to make a difference. What is the weight? You can see the weight of protest. You can see the weight of the politician Navalny and rigged elections and so forth, but you can see it. But for all, other than YouTube views, the anti-corruption activity, which has involved not just Navalny and Medvedev, but many of high-ranking officials, seems to have had zero impact other than in the West. And again, feel free to disagree. I'm just kind of waving a flag in front of you. On its own, corruption isn't going to move the needle. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think, first of all, to say that, I mean, Russians did react by and in decent numbers, around the hundreds of thousands, to this, in particular to the Medvedev investigation in 2017, and where that year Navalny was able, with that YouTube video and with his political appeal, to bring people out to the streets. So now the political system itself has not necessarily reacted to this, but if you look at what Russians tend to consider as the most important problems their country face, they will list corruption among the most important ones. It's possible that this focus on corruption has diminishing returns because, of course, well, you had Medvedev, then you had Putin, and then, I mean, it can only go downhill from there. And if the political system is not reactive to this pressure, I think it can obviously foster a sense of powerlessness and a sense of, and the second issue, I think, beyond this issue of diminishing returns is whether people are ready, in order to fight corruptions, to follow an adventurous politician advocating liberal policies. And then we turn back at the experience of the 90s where you had one politician, the first president of Russia, who campaigned already under the Soviet Union on the anti-corruption, anti-enrichment of the elite platform. And we know how the story ended. And this is not this points to probably the biggest challenge for people like Navalny in today's Russia. Maybe Ben wants to add something.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I was just going to add, Dan, to your point on it not really changing the needle. We can point to a particular example of that. When the Putin's Palace video was released on YouTube at the beginning of this year, now it's had more than 180 million views. Levada did a poll shortly after it was released, and it turned out that a quarter of the adult population in Russia had watched it. But then when they asked questions like, has it affected your perception of the regime or your level of support for Putin, we didn't see much change. So we got the idea that these investigations are really slick. Lots of people watch them. They sort of do lead to a certain type of splash, but it's not as if it translates automatically yeah. into people gasping and saying, oh goodness, I didn't know this about the current political regime. Let's go onto the streets. Let's man the barricades. That's not the case. So I definitely agree with what Morvan has said about powerlessness, a sense that this is an issue that's been on the agenda for a while as a critique of the political system, and maybe any shock value that it could have has gone. But that's also one of the reasons why Navalny, when he tried to run in the 2018 presidential election, he wasn't just a one-trick pony. He moved beyond anti-corruption as a message and put together a platform, including some left-wing policies. And that is a sort of indication of him being a politician, wanting to put together a broad coalition and maybe being slightly more populist than the liberal image that some people might have of him that wouldn't necessarily resonate with broader sections of the Russian population.
Well, let's use that as a shift from corruption to both politics and protesting, the two other silos that you have. And they're very close to one another. It's an interesting choice that you've made to split them, because I kind of see them as overlapping clearly. But it's been a challenging time. To being a protester in Russia is not an easy calling. Being a politician in Russia is an even more challenging calling. He's tried both. He's tried to be a politician via protests, and he's supported his protests via claims to being a politician. But it's been hard. And again, his politics are not the politics that we ascribe to him. They're his politics. Let's go into that path.
Well, for me, the starting point of Navalny's politics is that he is a liberal, and he has been for a very long time. He in a very interesting book of interviews he made with a journalist in the beginning of the 2010s, he said, like, when he was a teenager already, he found himself a liberal.
Defined
first in the political context at the time as someone who supported Yeltsin, who supported privatizations, who supported, was clearly anti-Soviet, who wanted Russia to be a democracy, whatever that means, and a capitalist free market economy, whatever that could mean to Russians circa 1991. And he cheered when Boris Yeltsin, crushed the Russian parliament, the Soviet Supreme, in 1993. And then he explains this as a result of his difficult business career. He realized that the promises had not been kept, that the principles of liberalism had not been upheld because, well, the 1993 crisis where you have a president shelling his own parliament, then the 1996 re-election of Boris Yeltsin, which was probably not the freest and fairest election that the world has known. And so he and this is in his own rendering of how it happened, he begins to harbor doubt, about liberalism. And he also begins to harbor doubt about liberalism because he finds they're too socially liberal, as we would understand in the West. They're too soft on immigration, they're politically correct. And so these two threads, let's say, his failing business career, the fact that, as he said, he realized that in Russia, money grows from power, his problems with immigration, with the situation in the Caucasus, this all brings him to try and experiment new agendas, new slogans, new ideas that we try to follow across the book.
And so again, that's I think while Navalny and in many ways more visibly until a few years ago, Yavlinsky move away from liberalism, the he in Russia, however that's defined, the Russian kind of Russia watchers still aren't moving away and are projecting onto them. And now Yavlinsky's made it very, very clear that he can't be tagged as a liberal anymore based on his most recent political performance. He's still hanging on in the Duma, but as a friend of the regime. So he evolves as a character through the experience of the rough and tumble experience of the 1990s in Russia. I was a graduate student for half of that decade there, and it was indeed shifting sands, to say the least, in terms of politics, not to mention everything else. And then the protest element. So as politics change, but he becomes almost like a professional protester. And that's an interesting element to it. It's high visibility, gets people out on the streets, but one again has to say, okay, what does this achieve? And the answer is we don't know yet, but it's a facet of professional organization of protests and getting people out. Can you describe that a little bit?
Well, it's clear that when Navalny tries to form a political party, the usual organizational manifestation that we think of, that we associate with politicians, he's frustrated at every turn. He isn't able to set up a political party. And so he says, OK, but I still need to form a movement in order to be a significant influential political force. And so he turns to protest as the way to advertise, to sort of boost his profile, but also to get supporters on board. And that's very much the reason why, in your mind, Dan, you say the political and the protest, they're fused together. We separate it in the book because we try and tell the story of Navalny attempting to be a quote-unquote normal politician, running in elections. So we talk about him running in the 2013 Moscow mayoral race and trying to run in the 2018 presidential election, but protest is a way in which he creates a Russia-wide movement. He moves out from the confines of Moscow and tries to be seen as a political figure of national significance. And in the book, one of the things that we think is a novel contribution, so even to those who know lots about Alexei Navalny, know all the stuff in the rest of the book, in chapter four, when we look at protest, we think that's an original contribution because we draw on Yan's work, his research, his conversations, the interviews that he did with Navalny's supporters and activists in the regions between 2017 and 2021. And with that research, you get the sense of Navalny broadening out, creating this organization in lieu of having a political party. But you also get a view of Navalny from the bottom up. You say that one of the problems with commentary on Navalny in Russia is we're using our Western assumptions and our Western viewpoints. It also means that we can look at Navalny and Russian politics from the top down. But with the voices that we get from Yan's research, we can see people complaining about certain features of Navalny, that yes, he claims to be a Democrat, and yet he runs his network of regional offices in a very top-down fashion. We also get people's different views on certain policy positions that he has, whether they agree with his calls for a relatively strict visa regime with workers from Central Asia. So chapter four, hopefully, is good for multiple reasons, for making it clear how the political is related to the protest, for how he set up this organizational network, which I should say was being dissolved when we were finishing the book. It was that weird, really weird situation of constructing the narrative of creation of an organizational structure. And we were reading in the news every day it being attacked and then eventually being dissolved. So that's the way that we try and separate out the story of the political and the protest. And it's just really shocking the degree to which that has all crumbled over the last 6 months.
So let's use that as a segue to kind of some other issues that I wanted to address briefly. The first is the state associated with the election, but maybe not associated with the election. The state's crackdown has been extreme. What has been the kind of follow-up to your book and your experience? The book came out a few months ago in Europe first, now just coming out in North America, getting a lot of coverage. What has been, you know, your experience or your if you had to write an addendum, an appendix to the book, what would it be given what's happened the last few months since you sent the typescript off?
It's a
silence, apparently. It's a tricky one.
it is a tricky one because, as Ben said, and as I think we should insist upon, is that we have witnessed in almost a year, but more tremendous transformations in Russian politics. This is the most massive political repression that we know under Putin. It can be argued that Navalny's organization was the most important organization independent from the Kremlin and the opposition in Russia today. And it has been repressed accordingly. There had never been so many arrests after a demonstration in post-Soviet Russia. There had never been so many criminal cases brought against protesters. So we're seeing, and of course, how can I forget this? There had never been such a high-profile opposition leader being the victim of an assassination attempt. So these are dramatic events that we followed as we were working through the book. And the strength, the pace, the breadth of the repression makes it hard not to write a kind of obituary to Navalny's movements. And this is something, again, to insist on that dimension, that we did not foresee, and I think that nobody foresaw it when we started writing. It happened in a couple of months. And when we started discussing the end of January, we were like, Navalny will go to jail, that seems for sure, but maybe his organization will be able to tread on. This didn't happen. And it's very difficult to see now, given how the political system is closing in Russia, where this is going and where you can get glimmers of hope, let's say.
Which is, again, the Western bias. Any specific response to the book that I think... it's the post-book narrative is just in many ways as interesting as the narrative. I understand what's going on in Russia, but what has been your reception among the Russia watchers and the media?
I'll definitely get to that, but I just wanted to add something that we are currently having discussions about whether we need to write an epilogue for some of the international translations. And our response at the moment, it might change very quickly, but our response is that the direction of travel at the end, in the concluding chapter, is really clear that actually the book shouldn't be that dated. It's clear in the final pages that we're saying, look, this is what is going to happen. Granted, in the book, we don't predict the extent to which the movement has been crushed. And yet, it's not as if we feel an urgent need to add that extra chapter, even if we might do it when the paperback comes out. Who knows? On the reception, it's been really interesting to get reactions from different voices. On the whole, we're really pleased with the reception. And the word that keeps coming up is that it's balanced, and balanced in a good way, that it's not as if we've written a document that is seen as coming from within Navalny's team and we're here just to applaud Navalny. No, we don't shy from tackling some of the darker pages, the more controversial pages of his history and those of his team members. So that I think if we're going to come up with one word that seems to be the reaction to the book, it's that it's balanced. And also it's been nice to hear that for Russia watchers, even if they might know some of the detail, especially at the beginning of the book with the general setup, who is Alexei Navalny, there is content in there that is new to them, or that they'd forgotten, or that they hadn't seen put together in one narrative to get the sense of flow, to see how the different elements of Navalny's life interacted with each other. And Morvan has been on various Russian media to talk about the book, so maybe he can speak about what the reaction on those platforms.
Yes, please.
The reaction, I went to Dozhd the day before they were labeled a foreign agent. I hope this is only a coincidence. And I went on to Echo Moscow tour, and I found that the reception was positive. One of the questions that I found really interesting, that also gets back to your point about perception between Russia and the West, is that I got asked, like, if Navalny was a Western politician, where would he stand on the political spectrum? And I think this is also speaks to that question of mirror perceptions, where you get the impression that, and it's a question that Navalny has been asked several times, like, oh, if you were an American politician, would you be a Democrat? Would you be a Republican, for example? And I found that question very interesting because it points to that also that need for many people who follow Russian politics and are Russians to find their way into the Russian and Western political spectrum, which are obviously built in very, very different ways.
Hence, again, this example of projection. So, has Margarita Simeonen given you a call, and she's got a party to share her impressions? So, let me just share with you as a reaction as a historian in placing, and perhaps we'll wrap up with this, placing Navalny in the context of Russian opposition leaders, which is a very interesting term when applied to Russia, because it's hard to be an opposition leader. But it's dating back to the 19th century and mostly in exile in the West, or internal exile, you could argue that what Navalny unfortunately is currently experiencing is internal exile, as it were, and that, you know, these are opposition voices against a regime that isn't going anywhere or has shown little evidence of that. Now, that's not a popular view, certainly among my circle of Western liberal friends, ever hopeful about a positive outcome for Russia, but I'll just throw it out there. And so I think there's a lot of opportunity to see Navalny in a historical context as well. I realize that was not your primary mandate to start with Herzen and end with Navalny, but that's one of the ways I was interpreting it as well. Gentlemen, thank you so much. The book is Navalny, Putin's Nemesis, Russia's Future, Jan Malti Dalban, and then I'm joined by Morvan Lalouette and Ben Noble. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.